start from the end of the Sedra and work our way back if there's time. Bilam, and obviously this is a nevuah from the Ribbono Shel Olam and not Bilam's own words, describes the Jewish people as Am Levado Ad Yishko, we're a nation that dwells apart. That's Klal Yisrael. In order for us to be able to achieve our purpose in this world, we have to be insulated from the rest of the nations of the world. Because if we'd be mixed up together with them, so we would learn from them and they would learn from us and we'd reach the lowest common denominator. But in order that we should be able to be a light to the nations of the world, and we should be able to influence them, they have somebody to look up to, we have to be separate from them to be able to develop a society that is different than what their requirements are. A goy can get olam haba too. Tzadikei umos ha'olam, chassidei umos ha'olam. They keep their seven mitzvahs properly for the right reason, they can get a share in the world to come. But a goy only has to be moral. And a Jew has to be holy. There's a difference between morality and holiness. For instance, a goy, as long as he does not, is not immoral, doesn't commit any immoral sins, so he fulfills his mitzvahs. But a Jew, right, even if he's not immoral, but for instance, there's an Isser Yichud, can't be alone with somebody that is not married to you. Okay, unless it's your mother or your daughter. So that's not immoral, right? We're really afraid that, you know, something's going to happen or whatever. I mean, it could be, but it's not holy. A goy is allowed to be alone, right, with good intentions, with a married woman or an unmarried woman or a relative. Right? A person can't be alone with his nieces. Is it because we're really afraid that something's going to happen? No. And it applies to any girl over 3 years old. But it's not because it's immoral, it's because it's not holy. And we have to have a different standard. Rashi brings down in the end of Parshas Kedoshim, V'avdil eschem min ho'amim lios li, I separated you from the nations of the world to be mine. On that Rashi says, Im atem muvdolim atem shali, if you separate yourselves, you belong to me. The imlav, and if you don't separate yourselves from the goyim, then atem shom nevuchadnetzer v'chaveirot, you belong to Nebuchadnezzar and his friends. So the simple meaning, I guess, is that if you separate yourself from the goyim and don't do the terrible abominations they do, I'll protect you. And if not, if you do those terrible abominations, I'll give you over into the hands of your enemies like Nebuchadnezzar. But it doesn't say that. It doesn't say, I'll give you over into the hands of your enemies. It says, you belong to him. And also, why single out Nebuchadnezzar? We had a lot of enemies before him and after him. Why him? See, what it means is the following. A goy only has to keep seven mitzvahs. If he's moral, basically seven is the natural world, 7 days of creation. And basically he has to maintain the natural world without abusing it and without distorting it. So if a goy remains at terms, synchronized with the natural world, right, keeps his seven mitzvahs, doesn't murder, doesn't steal, and so on, he'll get a share in the world to come. But if a Jew is moral and doesn't keep all the mitzvahs, not going to get a share in the world to come. Our mitzvahs are more than morality, they are holiness. And therefore, a Jew is the place where God's presence rests in this world. The Asuli Mikdash, make me a holy place, a Mikdash, the Shachanti B'Socham. It doesn't say God will dwell in the Mikdash. But the Mikdash is a vehicle to bring God's presence in the heart of every Jew. We are the Mikdash of Hashem. We are that holy place that represents God to the nations of the world. We represent God to the nations of the world. We're a Mamleches Kohanim. an empire of Kohanim. A Kohen is God's representative to the Jewish people. We're God's representatives to the world. So if we separate ourselves, not from the bad goyim, from good ones, who live a moral life, but in order for us to reach holiness, we have to be not isolated from them, but insulated from them. And therefore, if we separate ourselves, then we belong to Hashem, meaning we're His representatives. But if not, then we belong to the group of Nebuchadnezzar. What did Nebuchadnezzar do? He destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. So he destroyed the Beis HaMikdash of wood and stone, and we're destroying the Beis HaMikdash of our heart. We're destroying our holiness if we don't separate and we live the same kind of life that they do. And that's why, in order to be able to develop a society which is grounded not on morality alone, but on holiness, right, we need to be insulated from the nations of the world. That's why the Midrash says the Jewish people are compared to oil, and the goyim are compared to water. Oil and water can't mix. And if you try to mix them, eventually the oil rises to the surface. The Chaim Voloshiner says the Jew has only two choices. Either he can make Kiddush, or the goy will make Havdalah. Either we sanctify ourselves and separate ourselves, or the goy will push us out. And that's exactly what happens with the oil. When you try to shake the oil into the water, eventually it's the water pressure that pushes the oil up. So the goyim push us out. It's a safety mechanism that the Rebbeinu Shlom made, that if we try to assimilate amongst the goyim, it won't work too long. The goyim will push us out. And that is the whole reason we need Eretz Yisrael. We need Eretz Yisrael to create a society which is founded on holiness and not just on morality. In order to do that, you need to be insulated from the rest of the world. If you live amongst them, right, it's very difficult not to assimilate within them, as we see all over the world today too. Right? The majority of Jews are assimilating. So that's the purpose of Eretz Yisrael, to create a society where we can, everything in life can be holy. So that's what it means, Am Levadad Yishkov. Okay. It says that Bilam, he didn't have the power of actually cursing. He could harness the anger of the Rebbeinu Shlom. It says the Rebbeinu Shlom, there are times when the Rebbeinu Shlom gets angry, and he could harness that anger and focus it in one place and cause destruction. And it's like taking the rays of the sun and using a magnifying glass to focus them on one area and causing a fire, causing destruction. Bilam knew how to channel that anger that came into the world and focus it, and with that way he was able to give a curse. So the Rebbeinu Shlom's anger lasts for a fraction of a second, a millisecond. So they asked, what could he have said in that one fraction of a second to curse them? So some say that as long as you start when that anger is there, anything you say after that continues on. And some, the Aruch HaShulchan brings a proof from that, that if you start mincha before Shkia, even though you're not going to finish till after, you can daven mincha like that. The Mishnah Berurah says not like that. But you see from here that if you start something in the right time, even though after that the time goes by, you, since it started at the right time, that's a continuation of the beginning, and it's all considered within that opportune time. Yeah?
What does it mean, Hashem's anger?
It means that God put into this world, God is never changes. So he's constantly, broadcasting various emotions or various ideas and things to the world. And sometimes those things are, where the world is vulnerable to them, sometimes they're not. So the Rebbeinu Shlom, at certain times during the day, the broadcast from Shamayim is anger, because the anger is, there's things in the world that go on that deserve that anger, and then it has to be dissipated over the world in punishments or whatever that's necessary for the world to be able to function.
So we have that mitzvah, the Arach of the Drachav. So, but Rambam says that anger is not going to run out of any of. So are you actually supposed to have this amount of anger?
No, because the Halakhta B'drachov, the Gemara says, is only on the Midas HaRachamim of Hashem. the merciful midos. But midos hadin or whatever, there there's no union to be like the Rabbanu Shlom. The midos are only between man and man. How God has mercy on us, we have mercy. But how God functions, what you call, not for the sake of people, but for midos hadin, that's not part of v'halach the bedrachav. The midos are the midos of the yud gimel midos shel rachamim that we're supposed to emulate, not the midos hadin. Anger is a midos hadin. That applies by the Rabbanu Shlom. It doesn't apply by people. In any case, so that's one answer. They say that if you start at the time that it's effective, then even if you continue on in a non-effective time, everything goes after the beginning. And again, the Orach HaShulchan brings a proof from that, that if you start Mincha or Shacharis in the right time, within the right time, even though it's going to spill over to the wrong time, it's okay. The Mishnah Brura, like I said, argues on that. Another thing they say is he could have said, Tosas says he could have said the word Kalem, destroy them, in 1 second. And that could be said in 1 second, and they point out that if you look at the first letters of the Brachos of Bilam, which was really he meant to say as Klalos, they spelled out those words. The first bracha is Kilo Ra, Kilo Ra, Amol B'Yakov, Kimerosh Surim Erenu. I saw him, saw them from the heights of the mountains, which is the Avos. I saw them from the Avos and Imahos. That was the first bracha, and it starts with a Chaf. The second bracha starts with a Lamed, Lo Hibit Oven B'Yakov, Velo Ra, Amol B'Yisrael. And the third one is with a man, Matov Alecha Yaakov. If you put those letters together, you get Kalein. That's what he could have said in that 1 second. Okay. It says, Matovu Alecha Yaakov, Mishkinosecha Yisrael. So Chazal darshan this pasuk in two ways. One is that it refers to the Jewish home. Or Alecha means your homes of living, your tents. Mishkinosecha, your dwelling places. And it's talking about the Jewish home. And it's talking about the fact that Bilam was impressed with the tznius of the Jewish people, that their doors and windows didn't face each other. So people didn't look into other people's business. So they lived modestly. And however, Chazal also darshan these psukim as referring to bate knesios and bate midrashos, to shuls and yeshivas. So which is it? Are these ohalim and mishkanos, are they regular homes, or are they what's it called, shuls and bate midrashos? There's a medrash in Parshas Noach that seems with that we can resolve the seeming conflict. The medrash says like this: L'mishpichoseihem yotzu min hateva, that when they left the ark, Noah's ark, so they left by family. So the medrash says, Mikan sheyotzu mibeis hakneses mishpachos. When you leave shul, you should leave by family. That's what the medrash says. What's the simple meaning of the medrash? The word teva in Chumash means a boat, an ark, Noah's ark. But in the Mishnah, the word teva means the Aron Kodesh. Motzina sateva l'rechova shalir, ha'yored lifnei hateva. Teva in the Mishnah's language is the Aron Kodesh. Okay? In English, there is still that connection. We call Noah's ark an ark, and we call the holy ark an ark. So the Aron Kodesh and the Teva have a connection with each other. So the simple meaning of the Medrash is, just like it says, L'mishpichoseihem yotzu min hateva, when they left Noah's ark, they left by family. So when you leave the shul, you leave the ark, leave by family. Cute. What does it mean? What it means, I think, is the following. The Meiri says that the evil in this world is like the sea, like the ocean. And the way to escape it is like a boat. So the obvious question is, you can't escape the sea in a boat. The boat can't exist except on the ocean. He should have said, the evil in this world is like the ocean, and the way to escape it is an amphibious craft. Gets out of the ocean. Why a boat? But the idea is, you can't run away from evil in this world. there's no place that you can escape it. It exists everywhere. It exists in everybody's heart. It exists everywhere. So what can you do? You can't run away from it. You can insulate yourself from it, like we said before. Klal Yisrael can't isolate themselves from the world, but they have to insulate themselves from the world. So what is the insulation? You're amongst the sea, but the sea can't come in because you're in a watertight boat. What is the evil in this world, like the ocean, all the many negative things that surround us that would like to drown us in evil? How do you escape that? By creating a boat to insulate yourself from those waters. What are the boats? The boats are Bate Midrashos, Bate Knesios, Kehilas, Shul, Yeshivas. Those are the insulators to be able to keep the evil out. There's only one problem. You can't spend your whole life in a yeshiva, nor in a shul. Right? At some point, you have to leave, or even leave temporarily. So how do you leave the boat and still remain protected? That's what the Medrash says. L'mishpechoseihem yatzu min ateva. If you create families, homes, that have the same standards and values as the shuls and the Bate Midrashos, then they become like lifeboats. And you can leave the mother ship, but you're still in a lifeboat. That lifeboat is your own personal home, your own personal family. So if you want to leave the teva and still not be drowned, then l'mishpechoseihem, you leave by family, the family unit. If it has the same values and standards as the shul and the yeshiva, serves as a lifeboat to protect you also. Therefore, there's no contradiction between the Midrashim that say that when Bilam saw the homes of the Jewish people, he was impressed. Or that those are not the homes, those are the shuls and the Bate Midrashos. Same thing. Because you need them to be on the same page. You need them to be the same way. And both things are impressive. The shuls and the Bate Midrashos and the homes that have the same values and standards as the shuls and the Bate Midrashos. That's why every institution, a shul, a yeshiva, right, doesn't have it's not a value to itself. It's not a medrash, a knesset, a sefer. It's a beis haknesses, a beis hasefer, a beis medrash. You start with the house, with the home. You start with the home, and then you continue it, and you develop it into the home. Then extends into the shul, extends into the beis medrash of the yeshiva, and so on. But you always start with a bayis. You always start with a home that has those same standards and values. So there's no contradiction between the fact that Chazal learned this pasuk referring to the Jewish home, as opposed as other midrashim that say it applies to Jewish shuls and yeshivas. Okay. One last small thing, and then we'll go back to the beginning of the sefer with a few things. It says, Dorach Kochav Miyakov, Bekom Shevet Miyisrael. So the Rambam explains that this is referring to David HaMelech. Kochav, a star will shoot out of Yaakov. That refers to David HaMelech, who was the first anointed king, who was supposed to be a king forever. The line of royalty came from him. He was called the first Mashiach. The Kom Shevet Mishrael, and a staff will arise from Israel. That's Melech HaMashiach. That's the Mashiach. That's why they called Bar Kochva, right? Bar Kochav, from this pasuk. Now the Chora, if they thought he was Mashiach, they shouldn't have called him Bar Kochva. They should have called him Shevet. Because Shevet refers to Mashiach. Kochav refers to David. So first of all, they didn't call him Kochav, star. They called him the son of the star. That means Ben David. He was a descendant of David HaMelech, which is one of the conditions or the CV of Mashiach. He has to be from David HaMelech's family. So therefore he was Bar Kochva. He was the son of the star. A star refers to David. But still, they thought he was Mashiach. Why call him Bar Kochva? Call him Shevet. right? Come shevet mi Yisrael, shifta. So the Rambam says that if somebody comes and claims to be Mashiach, so what do you do? How do you know if he's Mashiach? Does he have to do miracles? Does he have to have a prophet come, and a prophet that is a legitimate prophet that is tested and proves that he's a prophet, come and say that he's Mashiach? Does he have to prove that he's a prophet and then say about himself that he's Mashiach? How do you know he's Mashiach? Somebody comes and claims he's Mashiach. I don't know if he's true or not. Says the Rambam, if somebody comes and he has the qualifications that apply to Mashiach, what are the qualifications? He is from Malchus Beis David. He is a legitimate descendant of David HaMelech, and he can prove it. He can show his yichus back to David HaMelech. First thing. Second thing, he's a tzaddik, both in Torah Shebichsav and Torah Shebal Peh, and a Talmud Chacham, and he fights God's holy wars. Could be physical wars, could be spiritual wars, and he brings back most of the Jewish people to Torah. If those are the qualifications he has, then he could be Mashiach. It's possible. He has all the qualifications to be the kind of person who could be Mashiach. So we assume that he's Mashiach. What does that mean? We assume that he is a rightful king. You have to listen to him. That's all it means. How do you know for sure he's Mashiach? So you have to listen to him as if he'd be a king. That's all. How do you know if he's really Mashiach? How can he prove it? He doesn't have to do miracles. He doesn't have to have any prophecy. What he has to do is three things. That's it, says the Rambam. If he does these three things, he, what's it called, is for sure Mashiach. He conquers all the enemies around Eretz Yisrael, brings all Jews back into Eretz Yisrael, builds a Beis HaMikdash. That's all he has to do. If he does those three things, he is for sure Mashiach. No shaila. If he doesn't do those three things, then he's not Mashiach. And it could be, the Rambam says, it'll take a long time to fulfill those three things. So there's a time when we assume he's Mashiach, b'cheskas Mashiach, and then there's a time when he proves himself to be for sure Mashiach when he accomplishes these three things. The Rambam says if he dies, or he's killed, and he doesn't accomplish these three things, then he's for sure not Mashiach. The Rambam does not say there's a chance he'll come back from the dead and be Mashiach. He just says for sure he's not Mashiach. So what is he? Like any kosher Jewish king who died, and you treat him like a king who died. Why would the Rabban Shalom fool somebody and make him think he's Mashiach when he wasn't? That's to test the Jewish people to see if they'll give up hope, right? If they would follow him when they thought he was Mashiach, whatever. It's a test. That's the Rambam. Therefore, Bar Kokhba never reached the level of proving himself to be Mashiach. The only thing he could prove was that he was a tzaddik, a Talmud Chacham, and that he descended from David. So that's why they call him Bar Kokhba. At the point where he died and was killed, where it was sure that he wasn't Mashiach, only thing he had established was that he was from Malchus Beis David and had the credentials of someone who was possible to be Mashiach. But he never accomplished what Mashiach was supposed to accomplish, and he was killed, so he, what's it called, he clearly was not Mashiach. But at least they gave him the designation Bar Kokhba, the son of the star, which applies to David. That much he's proven to us, that he's a legitimate heir to the Davidic throne. Now we have to assume that if he claims to be Mashiach, that he's Mashiach. If it pans out, fine. If it didn't, and it didn't, then he wasn't Mashiach. So they never called him Shevet staff, because that would have meant that they already considered him Mashiach completely. They didn't. They considered him a possible candidate, right? That it's possible that he has the right qualifications, and that if he accomplishes what Mashiach's going to accomplish, then we know for sure he's Mashiach. But at that point, all they knew was that he was Bar Kokhba. He was fit to be a descendant of David and similar to David HaMelech. That's all. Meaning a tzaddik and a person who fought God's wars or whatever. All the qualifications that the Rambam said is that you need in order to even consider the guy that maybe is Mashiach, that was called Bar Kokhba. But Shevet, that's only after he's proven himself. That never happened by Bar Kokhba. Okay. Let's go back to the Sfarno asked the following question. says that Balak told Bilam, I know that whoever you bless is blessed, and whoever you curse is cursed. So Sfarno asks, if that's the case, that Bilam had the power to bless, why did Balak ask him to curse the Jewish people? Why didn't you just ask him to bless him? Well, it'd be easier to give him a blessing. So could be, I was thinking that simply, that if he cursed the Jewish people, it could be they meet their end in some other way, through the curse. And he wouldn't have to get involved and fight them. But if he gave him a blessing, the only way that he could possibly overcome them is by fighting them. He didn't want to go to war. But he'd rather them have a curse and let them, die of some kind of illness or something. But the Sfarno says something else. The Sfarno says that Bilam had no power of blessing. Like we said, he could only harness the anger of the Rabban Shem and direct it. That was his curse, his power to curse. He had no power to bless. So then, why did Balak say, everybody knows, whoever you bless is blessed? It's not true. He said because he didn't want to insult Bilam and say, you're just a negative person who can cause damage. So as out covered for Bilam, he made up something that wasn't true. Everybody knows you can bless people and curse them. It's not befitting Bilam to say, everybody knows you're a guy who can curse people and damage them. Okay, that means that even for a Bilam, it is derogatory, right, and not respectful to say he's a negative person. Yet today there are people who pride themselves at being negative people who can, you know, stalk people and give it to them and criticize people. There are people who really take, you know, pride in their power of criticism and of putting people down. That's an insult to a Bilam. Surely not something that a person should feel proud about. And it says, in fact, that was what's it called, Bilam's main problem. He had only one eye, a very critical eye. And they can't live like that. You need two eyes. One critical and one that is, what's it called, not critical. The famous story of Reb Shimon bar Yochai and his son Reb Elezer in the cave for 12 years. And all they did was daven and learn and reach a tremendously high spiritual level. When they came out of the cave, so it says, wherever they looked and saw people involved in the mundane material things of this world, like planting, plowing, or whatever, they burned up the area. They were so critical. They couldn't take it. What are these people wasting their time on temporal things? They could be sitting and learning and davening and doing things that are eternally important. What are they wasting their time? They couldn't take it. So Baskol came out and said, get back in the cave. I didn't let you out of the cave to destroy my world. Get back in the cave. They went back in the cave for a year. They came out, and wherever Reb Elezer was looking, it still burned up. Wherever he saw people involved in temporal things. But Reb Shimon bar Yochai was able to heal it. So two questions bothered me. Firstly, if I were to ask you, why were these two people so critical? So yeah, the answer is because for 12 years they were in a cave, separated from society, living on a tremendously high level, and they couldn't understand how people could live on a lower level. So what's it going to help sending him back to the cave for a year? To make a problem even more problem. Send him to Miami. Send him to Las Vegas for a year. That will mellow them out. Don't send him back to the cave. That was the problem. And secondly, once they came out a year later and Reb Elezer is still burning things up, why is he allowed to stay out? Why didn't he go back in the cave? So I learned from that two things. Firstly, a person is not overly critical and intolerant because he learned too much. Because he didn't learn enough. The more a person knows, the more he can really understand other people and be tolerant of them. So another year in the cave would make them tolerant, not less tolerant. Secondly, a person can't be all critical or all everything is rosy, because both of those are false. If you're only critical, you're destructive, negative. If you're only, everything is fine, you know, I'm okay, you're okay, everybody's okay, then nobody will ever improve, and no things that need improvement will ever get changed. So you need a partnership. As long as the young guy, who's more, you know, critical, right, young people are more kanoim, but there's an older person who's more mellow, who can take that criticism and turn it into something constructive, that's fine. But if both of them are critical, or both of them are non-critical, that's no good. That's why a person needs two eyes. If you only have one eye, you can either see things all good or all bad. If you have two eyes, you see the whole picture. The difference between sight with one eye and two eyes is you see it in three dimensions. One eye, all you see is two dimensions. With both eyes, you see three dimensions. So in order to see the whole picture means you see the critical things, the things that need improvement, and you see how to do it, the positive. You put them together, that's fine. If you only have one eye, either you're seeing everything is fine and nothing should be criticized, which is wrong, or you see everything to be criticized and nothing is fine, and no way of saying it and putting it into a positive way. Okay. And one last thing, the Ibn Ezra. The Ibn Ezra says, what in the world did God go to such lengths to keep Bilam from cursing the Jewish people? Let him curse them. Who cares? You know, we used to say when we were kids, sticks and stones can break my bones, but names can never harm me. So why, if the Rebbe Shlomo doesn't want the curse to take effect, what power did Bilam have to give him a curse? If God doesn't want them cursed, they won't be cursed. So let him go say whatever he wants, all the words he wanted, all the curses he wanted, and nothing's going to happen. Why did God go to all these great lengths to prevent Bilam from cursing Jewish people? So the Shurei Das says a very simple answer. He said the question, to a certain degree, is predicated on the fact that we think that reality is the physical world, and the spiritual world is some kind of, you know, nice idea, but it's not real. Therefore, would you have the question, if Bilam perfected an atomic bomb and he was going to drop it on the Jewish people, okay, and God went to great lengths to stop him from dropping the atomic bomb, right, or changing the atomic bomb into some kind of colored water fountain instead of a weapon of mass destruction, would you ask the same question? What a difference it make? You know, if you drop an atomic bomb, God doesn't want it to go off, so it won't go off. What's the big deal? No, God created a natural order of things, and if you know how to make an atomic bomb and you drop it, and instead of it destroying everything in its path, colored water comes out of it and soothes people, that's a miracle. That's a miracle. And God doesn't usually do miracles. It's a tremendous miracle. So if you understand that the spiritual world is not only no less real than the physical world, but it's the real reality, then if somebody knows how to manipulate spiritual powers and create a curse, it has an effect. It's just as effective as shooting a gun or dropping a bomb. And if the Ribono Shel Olam turned that curse into a blessing, it's no different than somebody shooting someone and the bullet in midair turning into chocolate. Or into some kind of salve, right, that now coats the person and gives them some kind of refuah instead of killing them. That's a miracle. This is just as much a miracle. That's the Shurei Das. But Ibn Ezra says a different answer. He says like this. He says that God knew that the Jewish people were going to sin by Baal Peor, and 24,000 Jews were going to die because they were immoral. And if he let Bilam go and curse them, and then these 24,000 Jews died, what would people say? Oh, they probably died because of Bilam's curse. So in order not to have a possibility that people could attribute 24,000 Jews dying to a curse of Bilam, he didn't let Bilam curse them. He prevented him. Now, on the surface, I don't understand that answer. Because I would say just the opposite. Just the opposite. He should let Bilam curse them. Why? Because why did these Jews die? Because they were immoral. So better the world should know that Jews, 24,000 Jews died because they were immoral idol worshippers, than they died because Bilam happened to curse them and they died because of a curse. I think it would be better for the covet of Klal Yisrael, they died because of a curse, than they died because they were immoral idol worshippers. And this could be a great cover-up. Now they didn't die because they were immoral idol worshippers, they died because Bilam cursed them. So, one idea could be that if they died because of Bilam's curse, it seems that God's not in control of the world. Bilam can control the world. If they died because of a sin, so it's obviously God made them die, he's still in control of the world. So it's better to know they died of sins than to think they died because of a curse against God's will or something like that. But I have another answer, and that's the following. In last week's Sedra, I think we mentioned it last week, Moshe Rabbeinu's sin was he called, according to one opinion, that he called the Jewish people Morin. Listen, you rebels. And we asked, but after that, after he was punished and he did this sin, later on he said the same thing again, only worse. He said, you were rebellious to God from the time I knew you. So we explained last week from the Midrashi HaTorah, Reb Shlomo Astruc, there's a difference between saying the Jewish people are rebellious or they're rebels. Saying they're rebels, that classifies and describes them, what they are. Right? It labels them. Saying they're rebellious labels what they do, not what they are. You can say the Jewish people do terrible things, but not that they're terrible people. So Moshe Rabbeinu called them Morim, that's labeling them, that's wrong. Castigating them for doing things wrong, that's a different story. Same thing over here. How does a klala work? How does a bracha work? A bracha takes a positive something and increases it. Bracha means to increase. That's why you can always give a bracha on something. You can't have a bracha from nothing. Because if you multiply zero, you always get zero. You have to have something, and then if you multiply it, it becomes bigger. A klala is just the opposite. A klala takes a fault and enlarges it, intensifies it. When you intensify a negative, it becomes more negative. So the klala comes from the word kal, makes it light. It takes something negative and increases the negativity of it. That's a klala. And a bracha takes something positive and increases the positivity of it. Okay. If the Jewish people sin and they get punished, that doesn't say that they're terrible people. It says they did terrible things. But if it's possible for a curse to take effect, that means there's something intrinsically wrong with them that the person who cursed them can capitalize on and increase. Because if there's nothing intrinsically wrong, there's nothing to increase. So letting Bilam curse them, and then 24,000 Jews dying, and people saying, well, they die because of the curse, would imply there's something intrinsically an intrinsic flaw in the Jewish people. But if the world knows that they sinned, and that's why they died, then there's no intrinsic flaw in the Jewish people. It's just they're great people, but they do terrible things sometimes. That's not as bad as thinking that there's an intrinsic flaw in the Jewish people. Therefore, God prevented Bilam from cursing them, that no one should make the mistake to think that the 24,000 died because of a curse, which would imply that there's some intrinsic flaw in the Jewish people, right? Rather, it was better they should know they died of a sin, because that doesn't mean an intrinsic flaw, that means something they did. Their actions are no good, but not that their essence is no good. That's the idea.